Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Red Cross Giving Day. During the first 50 days of the year, Red Cross volunteers have responded to more big disasters across the United States than the calendar days this year. Wildfires, tornadoes, and house fires have strained the national blood supply. We'll learn more about how you can help today. How federal cuts are impacting election security in Pennsylvania and how ballot secrecy could be jeopardized by recent court rulings in the Commonwealth. Carter Walker of Vote BPA has the details. Celebrating International Trans Day of Visibility locally, and Resisterhood, blending music and activism to honor women. It's coming up, but first the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The controversy has grown surrounding top Trump officials and their recent use of a commercial messaging app to discuss U.S. military strikes in Yemen. A journalist from The Atlantic was inadvertently put into this chat. The Atlantic has now released the unredacted text messages. These messages detail the exact times for the attacks, the type of warplanes used, even one of the targets. But top Trump intelligence officials testified at a Senate hearing yesterday none of that information was classified. Connecticut Democratic Congressman Jim Himes wants more action.
With a screw-up of this magnitude, there's only one response, which is, we are terribly sorry. We are standing down. We will do the investigations. We will get to the bottom of this. We will make sure it never happens again. And there will be accountability for the people who were involved. You know what we didn't hear yesterday? A single one of those assertions.
Meanwhile, White House spokeswoman Caroline Levin has released a statement. She claims the entire Atlantic story is a hoax. The U.S. military attacks did occur. In Gaza, Palestinians staged a rare protest against Hamas, the militant group that rules the territory. Israel resumed fighting last week to pressure Hamas to release remaining hostages. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports.
Videos posted on social media show crowds chanting, "Out, out, out, Hamas go out." Protesters called for media coverage, chanting, "Where is the media?" Eyewitnesses say thousands took part in the demonstration in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza, which began as an anti-war protest. One protester who requested we only use his first name, Ibrahim, to speak freely against Hamas, told NPR, "Hamas is not taking us into account. It has 2 million people in Gaza who need to live." He called on Hamas to release the Israeli hostages and leave Gaza. Over the years, Hamas has cracked down on dissent, but open criticism has grown during the war. Hamas did not break up the protest. It issued no comment. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Stocks open mixed this morning as discount retailer Dollar Tree unloads its Family Dollar business. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 170 points in early trading.
Dollar Tree paid more than $8 billion to acquire the Family Dollar chain back in 2015, but the discount retailer has struggled to make the blended family work. So now Dollar Tree is selling off Family Dollar to a pair of private equity funds for about $7 billion less than it paid a decade ago. New orders for long-lasting manufactured goods rose last month, led by a jump in motor vehicle orders, but a key measure of business investment was down. Businesses may be reluctant to invest right now, given the uncertain economic outlook. People are still spending money on pets, though. Online pet store Chewy delivered better-than-expected sales for the most recent quarter and a tail-wagging forecast for the rest of the year. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now up 160 points. This is NPR. It was a year ago today, a cargo ship collided with the Francis Scott Key Bridge just outside Baltimore. Parts of the enormous bridge collapsed, killing 6 construction workers. The port of Baltimore was closed for months because debris choked the river. People around the world are switching religions. NPR's Jason DeRose reports on a new study from Pew Research that finds large portions of adults no longer practice the faith in which they were raised.
Religious switching is especially common in East Asia, Europe, and the Americas. In South Korea, Pew found that 50% of respondents had changed religions. In Spain, 40% said they'd left their childhood faith. In the U.S., 28% switched, and in Colombia, 25%. Christianity and Buddhism have experienced the largest losses. The biggest gains were among those who have no religious affiliation, atheists, agnostics, and those who describe themselves as nothing in particular. Pew found very small percentages of people either left or joined Islam. The retention rates for Hinduism and Judaism are also high. For the study, Pew surveyed nearly 80,000 people in 36 countries. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
Lawmakers in Florida are advancing a bill that would relax laws on child labor. The proposed change would let children as young as 14 years old work overnight and on school days. The legislation must be reviewed by two other Florida state Senate committees. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis says a younger workforce could help be the solution to replace labor by migrants who are in the United States illegally. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Thousands of families across the U.S. have lost their homes this year to wildfires, tornadoes, and house fires. At the same time, severe weather has disrupted blood donations, straining the nation's supply, according to the American Red Cross. Today is Red Cross Giving Day, and the organization is calling for both blood and financial donations to support disaster victims. Joining me now with more is Red Cross Hudson Valley Executive Director John Vail. John, good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. I was surprised when I was looking up this information in the introduction to the show to show that during the first 50 days of this year alone, Red Cross volunteers have responded to more big disasters across the U.S. than there are calendar days, and it's really straining the supply.
Yeah, Tim, it's really been amazing to see this year. You know, our disasters have set a whirlwind pace for us. And like you'd said, displacing thousands of people from their homes across the country and disrupting the nation's blood supply.
And the Red Cross is calling this Red Cross Giving Day nationally, set a goal to rally 30,000 supporters today. What role do you see folks in the Hudson Valley playing in achieving this ambitious target?
Oh, folks in the Hudson Valley play a critical role on Red Cross Giving Day and really every day, Tim. So every March we celebrate Red Cross Month. And this year, culminating with our Giving Day here today on March 26th. So we're really encouraging you, you know, if you've donated to the Red Cross or maybe haven't before, you know, really you can join individuals across the country. For we know every 8 minutes, someone in the United States is going to need the Red Cross. And generous donations like yours will enable the Red Cross to respond when help can't wait. And that help includes providing emergency shelter, food, relief supplies, emotional support, and financial assistance to those people in need. And as these extreme disasters grow in frequency and intensity across the country, and locally here, we see home fires upending lives every single day.
And locally, we've seen the impact of severe weather, winter storms, everyday crisis like home fires, as you mentioned. How does the Red Cross work support those affected by these somewhat more frequent, maybe smaller scale emergencies, I guess?
Absolutely. You know, home fires, like a lot of our disasters, are not planned. So individuals, you know, when they lose their home in a moment's notice, our volunteers, and they're, you know, about 500 across our Hudson Valley chapter, they come out to provide immediate assistance. And sometimes, yeah, that's in the form of financial assistance to ensure folks have somewhere safe to stay, can get food or clothing or other needed items. But sometimes, Tim, it's, you know, simple as providing hope. You know, someone's there to provide care. And then, you know, those additional services, like I had mentioned, providing emotional support. And most incredibly, you know, we were founded by a nurse, Clara Barton, and we have on-call nurses who can help, you know, fill emergency prescriptions or durable medical devices that are lost in fires or other extreme events. So it's really quite incredible when you see it all come together. And unfortunately, we're seeing this at a rapid pace here, you know, in the Hudson Valley and across the country.
Are you able to share any success stories or moments where you've seen the true impact of Red Cross volunteers locally in the Hudson Valley?
Yeah, so, you know, it takes, like I said, a large workforce. On average, we respond to about 150 home fires every single year in our six-county chapter jurisdiction. One success story, Tim, that I always, you know, really want to speak to is we actually, in response to the epidemic of home fires, we have a program that can install free smoke detectors in any household. And here in our Hudson Valley chapter, we've actually identified 17 lives that were saved through this program. And that's through a combination of a working smoke alarm, as well as that life-saving education that goes along with, you know, having an escape plan and making sure each family member can get out quickly and safely in the event of a fire. So I'm urging anyone who needs a smoke alarm to please call us. You can call 518-694-5121 or send an email to preparedness.eny@redcross.org. Tim, I'll share that information with you as well, maybe a flyer so you can get that out there.
Folks. We'll get that up on the website today. And also over 24 local volunteers from the Eastern New York Red Cross region were deployed to California and Kentucky to respond to the wildfires and flooding in those areas. How do they make a difference on the ground there when they go out from here?
Yeah, we have incredible volunteers. You know, they not only are responding to home fires, you know, here in the Hudson Valley, but like you had said, you know, they're out there supporting individuals affected by our larger scale disasters. And you know what? 2025 picked up right where 2024 left off. You know, we saw the incredible devastation out in California. So we've actually had the same about a group of individuals that have both deployed to California and now down in Kentucky. And what they're doing is providing, you know, that level of critical support for our sheltering, for our feeding operations, as well as, you know, that on-the-ground work to help identify, you know, communities and individuals in need. So it's really incredible. You know, again, here as a volunteer, you can not only help your neighbors, but when, you know, individuals across the country need us, you can answer that call as well.
So as I mentioned, it's Red Cross Giving Day. More than two ways, but the main things you were looking for are blood donations and financial support. So let's talk about blood donations and those blood supply needs. Again, we've said there's a significant disruption in blood donations due to all these issues so far this year. And we're heading into the spring weather and, you know, those disasters that might be coming. So where can folks go to help meet this critical demand?
Yes. So we are calling on blood donors of all types. So it doesn't matter, you know, your blood type or maybe you're unsure. Again, all healthy, eligible donors are encouraged to roll up that sleeve today. The best way to find your nearest blood drive is to go to redcrossblood.org, make an appointment. You can also use our Red Cross Blood Donor app. And this month, Tim, it's really exciting. I know we're quickly approaching the end of March. But all donors that complete a successful donation during the month of March will receive a free A1C screening for diabetes and pre-diabetes. So again, we're encouraging folks, you know, not only will you feel good because you're helping someone in need, but you can also receive, you know, some very vital, you know, health information as well. If you're kind of on that, maybe on the, you know, fence on donating or not.
And financial donations can go a long way with disaster relief, of course. But if someone's maybe not able to contribute a large sum, can you talk about how even a small donation can help make a difference?
Absolutely, Tim. You know, every donation matters. When we look at, you know, what your impact here, you know, a donation of $3 can provide a comfort kit. So those are kits that we provide mainly to families that are affected by home fires. They have toothbrushes and, you know, combs and shampoo. A gift of $11 can provide a nutritious meal, a snack, or a drink. And all of these are for folks impacted by disaster. All Red Cross disaster assistance is free. And again, this is only made possible through our generous donors. So today is the day. If you've thought about it before and you want to help someone in need, really quite an incredible way for us to provide that when the time comes.
And I mentioned, you know, the spring and the disaster season here. What are some of the biggest challenges Red Cross is expecting to face this spring, and how can the community prepare to help?
Sure. Yeah. So with the spring comes kind of this unstable weather. You know, it might be warm one day. You know, I know we're getting snow.
Cold today.
You know, we're getting snow up in the Adirondacks. So, you know, just kind of, you know, just making sure we have the volunteers, you know, in place and trained and ready to go. is an immense priority for us, but also making sure we have strong partnerships and donors, again, who can back our work. This is all the important work that what we call on a blue sky day like today, when there's not a disaster occurring, that we need individuals stepping up to join us and make sure that we can provide that assistance when it's needed most.
That's John Vail. He's the executive director of the Red Cross Hudson Valley. We're talking about Red Cross Giving Day, which is today. There's a critical need for blood donors. And also, you can double your impact for Giving Day if you make a financial donation. There's more information at redcross.org. John, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tim.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, some efforts in Pennsylvania that might impact secrecy of ballots in the next election. Vote Deep PA's on it. We'll hear more after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, the unknown history of the iconic little black dress.
Something about dressing rich, mostly white women is uncomfortable, especially while you're wearing the little black dress, your work uniform. You begin to wonder, why do I look like I'm her maid?
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill. Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Pennsylvania's top election official is warning the federal government that its decision to end a program that helps monitor and prepare for election threats will, quote, make elections less secure, end quote. In a letter to U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, first obtained by VoteBeat and Spotlight PA, Secretary of the Commonwealth Al Schmidt noted the risks of withdrawing support for local election officials provided by the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Carter Walker of VoteBeat PA spoke to Jason Dole about that and about how recent decisions from a Pennsylvania state court could create a new route to pierce the secrecy of some mail ballots and reveal the private choices made by thousands of voters.
There's been a lot in the news recently about cuts to the federal government at every level, but specifically there is this agency that helps coordinate election security around the country, and that's part of the Department of Homeland Security. It's this little agency within there called the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency that was set up in 2018. And part of what they do is they help share information about threats to cybersecurity or physical security across election offices all around the country. They help do assessments of election offices to make sure that that they're safe. Maybe some of your listeners saw a story out of Luzerne County from before the election that they were setting up boulders in front of their elections office kind of to prevent people from driving through the windows. That's the kind of thing that CISA would be doing. And now the Trump administration is cutting the funding for those programs and laying off staff in that agency.
We're talking about the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which you say is part of Homeland Security. And were there any other incidents where CISA's support made a difference recently in the elections? You mentioned that Luzerne County example.
Yeah, definitely. And that's like one of the routine things that they do is making sure that the offices are prepared in case anything happens. But what Secretary Schmidt here was highlighting in his letter to Secretary Noem of the Department of Homeland Security, urging her not to cut these programs, was other things that CISA has provided, particularly last year, that the states just couldn't do on their own. For instance, there was in early September, there were some letters being mailed around to elections offices with white powder in it that was suspicious, probably making people think back to the anthrax scares of the early 2000s. And within a couple of hours, the state was able to get photos of those envelopes and share it with their postal inspectors that govern this region of the country and election officials so that everybody knows, oh, hey, if you get a letter that looks like this, don't open it. Call the authorities. This could be part of this thing. You, of course, remember all the bomb threats that were going on Election Day throughout the country. The CISA was coordinating with elections jurisdictions on that, letting them know, hey, you know, we're seeing this elsewhere. This is what this threat is looking like. If you encounter something, this is probably what it is. Let us know. So they were able through these two programs that they funded to share information across states, across counties, that the counties say and the states say, like Schmidt is pointing out, we wouldn't really be able to do that on our own. You know, obviously, Department of State here in Pennsylvania and elsewhere, and of course the counties, they don't really have intelligence units set up like the federal government does. So they have all been pretty clear, everybody I've talked to beyond just Schmidt, that, you know, these programs were really integral for them in getting this security information.
You're reporting for Pennsylvania, but VoteBeat covers the whole country. So it's real easy to see what your colleagues are reporting on, and also easy to go back and see your past articles. And I'm seeing in February, you have an article about state election officials wondering why cybersecurity agency skipped their meetings. Is this the same agency that we're talking about now, that and they skipped a meeting back in February?
Yes, that is. There are these, you know, like most industries, there's these yearly conferences of the people in it. And for the elections public space industry, the CISA, who's, like I said, the elections community views them as an integral partner for their security needs. And they're almost, up until now, as far as I know, they've always been at these yearly conferences. And this year they were absent, and people definitely took notice of that. I guess it was a bit of foreshadowing now that we're seeing what's happened in the time since. But this is an agency that I think has drawn a lot of criticism from conservatives over the past couple of years. If you'll recall a statement from after the 2020 election, that the 2020 election was the most secure in American history. I might be paraphrasing that a little incorrectly. But that came from CISA and drew a lot of anger from Donald Trump after that election. So this has been one that's been in the radar for a while.
You know, again, we have a president who has a history of undermining elections, you know, whether that's just through his rhetoric, if not direct action. And there's been some direct action interfering with elections under him as well. But you're saying that this isn't just a general sort of, hey, we're cutting government, hey, we're cutting infrastructure, which they're doing across the board. You're saying this one might be a little more personal for him.
Well, I don't know how much he thinks about it personally, but it has been one that he specifically singled out and had issues with before. So I think,
and specifically because they were giving information that countered his false narrative about a stolen election too, is what we're talking
about. Exactly. Yeah. So I don't think the cut here with that context, it makes it a little less surprising.
So how are local election officials on the ground in Pennsylvania reacting to the news of these cuts?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, everybody's really just trying to, I think, figure out exactly what's happening right now. If you read Schmidt's letter, this is, like you said, we have reporters all over the place. So this is kind of part of the body of work we've been doing on CISA recently. And there was a letter from the Arizona Secretary of State where he had written that he was of the understanding that this review that the Department of Homeland Security is undertaking that is causing the funding cuts has been finished, and like this is the end result of it. Schmidt's letter says, you know, we know the review's ongoing. We're trying to get some clarity, and that's kind of the vibe I've been getting around the country, is that people are just kind of unsure what the future of this branch of the government, of this agency, is. Like, is this review going to result in them saying, okay, fine, we've heard from enough election officials that this is a valuable resource, so we're going to continue it? Is this, a temporary pause in funding, or is it now permanent? So I think there's just a lot of confusion on where this is all going to head. I think I had seen just yesterday or the day before that some jurisdiction states are looking to perhaps create their own version of this information sharing apparatus. But, you know, that is probably going to be a heavy lift. Because, like I said, you know, states just generally don't have intelligence units.
It sounds like you're saying like it's a little too early to tell exactly how local election officials will respond because they don't fully know what they're responding to yet.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when I had started reporting this story, helping out a reporter from Arizona, there are, I don't want to get too technical, but there's like two programs that help distribute this security information. One starts with the initials EI, and then the other one starts with the initials MS. And the one with the EI had its funding paused. People knew that for a couple of days, and folks were holding out hope that, okay, well, maybe they're just trying to consolidate these things and things will run under the program with the initials MS. Maybe the Trump administration is just viewing this as a little duplicative, and that's where we're going, even though people really liked the election-specific one. But then, you know, it got reported that, okay, the MS, that funding is paused too, so both of these are off the table. So, yeah, I mean, clearly just election administrators understanding in just a couple of days about what was happening was changing. So, like you said, yeah, people are just trying to figure out what is happening now and where this is going to go.
And the people we're talking about right now are the people that run elections. You know, as we wrap up on this story here, what about the people that vote in elections? What should voters know about these developments?
Yeah, well, I think it is difficult sometimes to translate this to the voter level because this is the kind of stuff that your elections officials are dealing with behind the scenes. But, you know, what it will mean is if the state officials and the county officials they work with don't have this information that trickles down from the federal government in a secure and quick manner, which is what these programs were designed to do, you know, it could make the counties slower in responding to these kind of incidents. Like in Pennsylvania, when we had, and I want to be clear, you know, I'm just speculating on a hypothetical of how this could work out, but in Pennsylvania, when we had those bomb threats on Election Day, it had been well established in part through this program that these bomb threats were related to other ones we had seen around the country and were most likely a foreign hoax. It did disrupt some county operations here in Pennsylvania. It was for a relatively short time. So, you know, I'm wondering what happens next time we have a bomb threat like that. If the local election official doesn't know immediately through these information sharing programs, oh, I got an email that looks exactly like the one that was sent out in Georgia, that means I'm probably facing the same kind of thing. You know, it's going to make them act differently towards that scenario.
You just recently published another article that says election officials worry that Pennsylvania court rulings could compromise ballot secrecy. Sounds like you're tracking a number of potential threats to the successful execution of elections in Pennsylvania. So what is this story about? This is about what the courts are ruling on within Pennsylvania?
Yeah, that's right. There's been a couple of court decisions, too, in the past year that have said that voted mail ballots, like actual mail ballots that people filled out and turned in and were counted, are subject to the state's open records laws, which means, in theory, anybody can go in and request access to them. Usually you have to be a registered voter in that county, but get access to and actually see the ballots. And the objections to that the counties and the Department of State have been bringing up is that, well, if you do that, then for some voters, if you take the actual ballot and some other already public voting data, which I try to be a little bit vague about to not give people a roadmap, but you could take that and you could actually link the ballot to some voters and figure out exactly how a person voted, which, you know, having a secret ballot has been a cornerstone of our elections since the middle of last century, to try and prevent vote buying or intimidation for somebody to vote a certain way. We took a look at the Department of State and the county's theory of how this would work out. And I do believe it is indeed possible to connect a person's actual mail ballot to an actual person, but the circumstances are pretty limited, and it only applies to about, I was able to find about 10,000 ballots that could be identified in this method across 14 million cast in the past 2 years. So it's a very small number, but of course you don't want anybody's vote revealed, which is what the Department of State and the counties are arguing. But people pushing for more transparency in elections, and I should say that's not just a conservative push. There's also a number of nonpartisan organizations like the ACLU pushing for these ballots to be accessible too, to promote more trust in elections. And the argument that they make is that, well, you know, we don't have to just withhold ballots to achieve secrecy. There are already some, like right now, today, there are already some voters whose votes are at risk of being exposed just through the elections results that we release. And again, without getting too much into the specifics, if you know how to look at the elections data the right way, you would be able to identify specifically how some people voted in some limited circumstances. And so they argue, well, since that's already the case, we shouldn't restrict releasing these ballots if that's going to promote transparency in our elections. And there are other things that we can do, like combining some of the smaller precincts together. And this is really a problem in the smaller precincts, or maybe we redact certain information so that you can't expose secrecy through these methods. But their point is that we can't just wholesale have a policy of not releasing this information, because as one of the people I quote in that article puts it, if you are hiding something, even if there's nothing nefarious going on, people are going to think that there is just because of the fact that you won't release it.
Yeah, Marion Schneider, Senior Voting Rights Policy Counsel at ACLU, Pennsylvania, that's that quote there. You're just creating more conspiracy theories because it looks like you have something to hide. So right. Is this an ongoing active debate, and is there any potential resolution on the horizon, or is this becoming a moot point?
It is ongoing, and not just here in Pennsylvania. You know, this has been becoming more of an issue across the country. We have a colleague in Arizona who's done some reporting on this, and I cited a study that looked at some of the ballots out in Arizona that shows this is a problem there. This is a problem in Texas, one of my colleagues there reported on. And it's due to the fact that we're releasing more data about elections now than ever before, probably. And people that know how to look at this properly can expose votes for some people. And we saw that happen to a prominent Republican in Texas. He had his vote revealed. So there have been states that have recognized this issue and sought to combat it while still balancing that transparency that we all want. You know, they've done that, like I said, through combining precincts or through saying, okay, well, if you only have five voters in a precinct, maybe don't release the information from that precinct because it makes it too easy to identify them. So there are workarounds, nothing that I've seen proposed here in Pennsylvania yet, but this issue is also still making its way through the courts. These decisions I'm referencing, they've been appealed up to the state Supreme Court. We'll see if the court takes that case there. And there might still be other avenues for the counties to argue legally against releasing these ballots. They're making arguments based on one section of the law right now, but there could be others available to them. So it's not quite settled yet. And I guess we'll just have to see where it goes.
Carter Walker reports for VoteBeat PA. His work is up at VoteBeat.org, and so is the work of his colleagues doing this kind of in-depth reporting on elections across the country, VoteBeat.org. Carter Walker, as always, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, celebrating the International Transgender Day of Visibility locally, this is Radio Chatskill.
On the next Radio Lab, the story of one building.
A secretive government compound where they keep secret files.
Miles of documents.
The files in that building, if they were ever released, could rewrite 200 years of history.
The village was like a concentration camp.
Documents that illustrate and prove it beyond doubt.
Like, why isn't this a tale that everybody in the world knows?
That's on the next Radio Lab.
this afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. International Transgender Day of Visibility is March 31st, Monday. It's an annual event that occurs every March 31st and has been since 2009, dedicated to celebrating transgender people and raising awareness of discrimination faced by transgender people worldwide, as well as celebrations of their contributions to society. Locally, Transgender Plus Support Initiative is hosting a free brunch in Calicoon, New York on Saturday to celebrate Trans Day of Visibility. Anne from the Transgender Plus Support Initiative joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Transgender Plus Support Initiative and the group's role in supporting transgender folks in Sullivan County and Wayne County?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're a small group. We just started last year. And our mission is to provide safer spaces for the trans and non-binary community. We're working to bring them together to provide more resources, provide connections to resources for these individuals. We have a monthly meeting. We have a family support group and a peer group that meet. And we're trying to do what we can for this community.
Transgender Day of Visibility is celebrated internationally on Monday. Locally, there's the brunch we mentioned, and we'll get more details about that. It's happening on Saturday in Calicoon. But what does this day mean to you personally and the communities you serve in Sullivan County and Wayne County? And why is it important to have a day dedicated specifically to visibility, especially in the current climate?
It's very important. Only about 40% of people actually know someone who's transgender, and it's important for them to be aware of some of the issues they face, but also to be aware that they are our neighbors and our family members and our loved ones. I'm the parent of a transgender child, and there are a lot of challenges. And so our work is to try to help bring education to people and bring awareness and to support the transgender community and their families and loved ones. And Transgender Day of Visibility is really a day to do that and to celebrate their accomplishments and you know, some of the great works they've done. I mean, they're human beings like you and I. You know, there's the discrimination and the violence and the hate that's directed towards them is unfounded, and it's a moment for us to just come together and spend some time together and get to know each other.
Against this backdrop of increasing hate and political and social hostility toward the transgender community, how has that environment affected your work and the people you support?
Well, I think it's highlighted the importance of what we do and the importance of helping to find resources and helping to connect people so they're not so isolated and to stand up. And it's important, I think, just to tell stories, to tell the story. You know, I mean, our story is of a family who, you know, just is raising a brilliant, beautiful child. Mm-hmm. And the focus is on, people are focusing on what's different, but there's so much of us that's the same, that we share. And I think it's important to recognize that being transgender is just one very small part of a transgender person, that, you know, they have talents and loves and fears and family and lives just like everyone else. And I think it's important for us to recognize that and to get to know them as people.
Was that some of the motivation behind hosting this brunch in Calicoon, to open it up to the community, to show and be more visible to the community about the human nature of everyone, right?
Yes, yes, it is. And it's also a moment, you know, I mean, we have our meetings with agendas and so forth. And so this really was a chance for us all to come together at a more social event and get to know each other and have conversations and just kind of a informal gathering, you know, where it's more of a social conversation and a time to just get to know each other mm-hmm. as people. And so, yes, we feel it's important for our group and also for the community to get to know us.
Tell folks more details about how they can get more information and what you hope to share with the community on this day on Saturday.
Well, for more information, we have an email address. This is the best way to contact us. Our email address is TSI for Trans Support Initiative Group 24, the numbers 24, at gmail.com. And that's really the best way to get a hold of us. Mm-hmm. What we're hoping is to spread the word and to reach more people and to celebrate. It's an important day for our community.
And I mentioned that it's a free event. Are you asking folks to bring anything, or again, what can folks expect?
They can bring something if they'd like. It's not necessary. If you know in advance that you're coming, if you could shoot us an email so we have an idea of a head count, that would be appreciated. But mostly, just bring yourselves and get to know us.
Here in our rural area, Sullivan, Wayne County specifically, how are folks dealing with the stigma and discrimination that they're facing, and some of this, we mentioned hate and hostility in our communities?
Well, I think working towards doing something has been very important. Being there for each other, being able to listen to each other and support each other. One of our missions is, especially in this area, there's a need for resources for this community, for medical, legal support services for this community. And so bringing awareness to that and trying to locate and connect more resources is a big mission of ours. And also to be aware of some of the changes in laws and some of the things that are happening. It's difficult, and it's hard to deal with. But knowledge is important, and we need to be aware of what's going on and do what we can to bring hope.
Before we go, what can allies do, local communities do right now to show support for the transgender community, both during Transgender Day of Visibility, but also just throughout the year?
It sounds trite, but be kind. You know, listen. Don't judge. Don't assume. Remember that we're all human and we're all people. And I think recently, it's been easy to categorize and try to put people in different buckets, and that's not the case. We're all different, and it's our difference that makes us all beautiful.
We've been talking to Anne from the Transgender Plus Support Initiative here in Sullivan County and Wayne County. They have a brunch on Saturday in Calicoon, New York, to celebrate Trans Day of Visibility, which is actually on Monday internationally, but we're celebrating it locally on Saturday. For more information, you can email tsigroup24@gmail.com. Anne, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Tim. I appreciate it.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Resisterhood. It's a new community choir blending music and activism to honor women. That's next after a break. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, our guest is poet, author, and meditator Diego Perez, better known as Young Pueblo. He's known for his advice on personal development and healthy relationships. He'll talk to Forrest Hansen about his new book, How to Love Better. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. A new report on the gender pay gap from the New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli shows that women in New York earn 87 cents on the dollar compared to men. That's stats from 2023. This new data comes amidst ongoing federal cuts affecting women. In January, President Donald Trump signed several executive orders, including cutting the federal funding of abortion and eliminating all diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in the government. Locally, some people are stepping into action. One group in Ulster County is using song to share their vision for social change. Radio Catskills Kimberly Izar had a chance to chat with Michelle Zipp, founder of Resisterhood Community Choir, on how she's blending music and activism to honor women.
Michelle, your social pages describe Resisterhood as an activist group promoting justice and positivity with song. Can you tell me a little bit more about what your group does and why you founded Resisterhood Community Choir?
We started in it was in 2016, and the women's movement sort of rekindled the ever-evolving women's movement that has been going on since the dawn of time. And we were a small activist group of local women where I live in New Paltz, and we were just looking for ways on how we can help on the local level to then affect change on the global level, hopefully. And so we had a benefit for the ACLU, which was an art auction of local artists donating their works, and we raised a few thousand dollars there. And then we had another event called After Me Too, and that was a very heavy forum, as one could imagine, talking about, we had therapists there who were helping folks through different experiences or sharing stories and empowering people, and also teaching us bystander training, what to do if we see someone being sexually harassed. And when we were planning that event, we were like, wow, this is really heavy. And how can we give something to the event that is uplifting? And we thought of song. And so we embarked on getting some local folks to sing with us, having zero musical training. And when we put it out there to the universe, a choir director, Debbie Lan, saw our, flyer somewhere, and she came to the first practice. And as luck would have it, she already was teaching her other ensemble the song. It was Quiet by Milk, which was a women's march anthem. And she, helped us teach the song to about 22 voices, I believe it was. And so at the end of the event, we sang that song, and it was just such a message of empowerment for folks there, and this uplifting moment, honoring the gravity of what we were doing, but also filling all our hearts with something positive or some kind of empowerment so we can take that with us into the world. And so from that, Resisterhood Community Choir was born, because we were just so in love with being able to seek these songs that had such meaning and to work with other people who were willing to put these voices to song and to put that energy out there and to really, meticulously choose songs that had great messages. And it's really to change the vibration of not only the folks who are singing, but anyone who will listen. So
that's beautiful. And I love the way that you described the way that music can create change in people's lives. I also understand that your group, not only has performances throughout New York, but also organizes other mutual aid efforts. Can you share a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So we practice every Monday at the Marbletown Community Municipal Center, which is just outside of Rosendale and Stone Ridge. And we're open to all genders. We just happen to all be female identifying currently in our roster of about 25. And we just look for different organizations that are local to donate each week. So we do a collection each week, and folks could give, depending on what they have. There's no charge for us to sing together, but we are like, okay, how can we $5 a week put in a little baggie that we have, a dedicated bag to donate to different charities. We've donated money to Millions of Butterflies, which is a local free food fridge that supplies food to local folks, anyone who needs it. We've also worked closely with Family of New Paltz over the years, which is the larger umbrella Family of Woodstock. And we do also a maxi pad collection every year, which we've collected thousands and thousands of maxi pads, which is a great need for folks who are unhoused or folks who do use Family of New Paltz for a lot of different resources. It's really about seeking those different organizations that could use some funds and, you know, being able to, as a collective, collect little bits here and there. It really adds up to help folks. And when we learned about the Women's Academy, which is under the umbrella of the Ulster Immigrant Defense Network, I was just so excited to be able to learn about them, and which is a new organization within the Ulster Immigrant Defense Network, but also to dedicate very needed funds to their work.
Yeah, and I would love to talk a little bit more about the Women's Academy and the fundraising event that y'all are hosting this Sunday. The Sunday Resisterhood is hosting a fundraising event called Honoring Women's Work in New Paltz. Can you share a little bit more about where the funds is going and who are the other groups or speakers who will be at the event?
Sure. And I just to backtrack on your 87 cents on the dollar that women make compared to men, if delving into that study a bit more, women of color make even less than that. So, and obviously immigrant women likely make very less than that as well. So the discrepancy really trickles down, and it really is an issue that has been ongoing. So the event is on this Sunday. It's from 3 to 5:30 at the Redeemer Church in New Paltz. And we teamed up with the Redeemer Church, who donated the use of their space without cost. So 100% of our proceeds can go towards the Women's Academy. And they have this beautiful community room with a focus on unity that they rent out or share with folks in the community. We have, it's a $25 entry, and with one lucky prize roll, I have this game I created. It's our version of a board game where we have local donations of everything from earrings to gift certificates to local restaurants, soaps and teas and teapots and pottery. The big prize is dinner for two at Mohonk Mountain House. And so you roll the dice and you move your little piece, depending on what the dice was. And then the piece you land on is what you win. But we have winners. Everyone is a winner, whether it is the big prize or, you know, a piece of chocolate or some seeds for planting this spring. So 100% of those proceeds will go towards the Women's Academy. And the Women's Academy focuses on immigrant women who are here, and it's educational, it is empowering, they teach them classes to help them, you know, learn the ins and outs of what it's like to live here in New York. They help supply them with housing and childcare and jobs, depending on each person's need. So it's really a beautiful organization that just works with equity and equality and helping these folks who really need a little help through our system, through our, you know, our community, and just becoming, being able to feel really welcomed into our community. So we felt that was a really great cause for this event. This year we have music by Shamsi Rue. She's an amazing singer based out of Woodstock. She's a singer-songwriter. She plays acoustic guitar. She is just so incredibly talented. And honestly, to see her sing, I always feel like people who have never heard her before are just so moved by the beauty of her voice and how her storytelling comes through in her music. We also have art by Bobby Esmark, who happens to also be a member of Resisterhood Community Choir as well. She's a multimedia artist, does very beautiful paintings and different works. We also have Mala Hoffman, who is a writer who's going to share some words with us. really empowering stuff as well. And then Resistorhood Community Choir, we have all songs that we're singing are actually written or sung by women. So the focus really is to uplift and spotlight women's work and women's contributions to arts and society.
I also want to lift up that I know you're in community with multiple partners across Ulster County, some of the folks and organizations you've already mentioned. I'd love to hear a little bit more about what you're hearing from your partners about the current needs to protect women, especially those with intersecting identities like women of color, trans women, that may be targeted on multiple fronts by the current administration.
It's interesting. I ran into another local activist, Maggie Veve. She works with UACT and does a lot of community work as well. And I happened to run into her in an unlikely place in an office. And we were just, you know, excited to talk to each other about the different events and needs and contributions that we can all contribute together to try to help other folks in our community. The immigrants being one of many. I mean, there are just pick any group, and there's definitely a need for help under this administration, but always. So, you know, I think that's what's important too, is to remember that the work needs to always be done, no matter who is in office, because we need to make sure that there is equity across the board.
Absolutely. And how can people stay connected with Resistorhood's work? Are you also looking for new members?
Yes, we are always looking for new members. I had someone who heard us sing at practice one day, and they just contacted me. So I love that. We sing every Monday at 6:45 until 8:15 at the Marbletown Community Center. It's free to join, and like I said, we do collect some funds if you're able, but if you don't have funds to contribute, that you can still be a member. It's not required. And really they just have to contact me or just show up to a practice, really. Our email is resistorhoodnewpaltz, one word, @gmail.com. But we're also on Facebook and Instagram.
Michelle, thank you so much. Michelle Zipp is the founder and member of Resistorhood Community Choir in New Paltz. Their event honoring women's work is this Sunday, March 30th, from 3 to 5:30 p.m. at Redeemer Church in New Paltz. Michelle, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kim.
And thanks to our Kimberly Iser for that. That'll do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Before we go, happening now on Capitol Hill, NPR CEO Catherine Maher and PBS CEO Paula Kerger are testifying before the House Oversight DOGE Subcommittee addressing questions about federal funding for public broadcasting. The hearing is called, quote, Anti-American Airwaves, holding the heads of NPR and PBS accountable. It's led by Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. Well, let's listen in for a moment.
And you know, I have a problem with that, because if people in Alaska, if all they have is public radio, then all they know is what these headlines say. And they're wrong about COVID-19. And the headlines are in the background. I don't have time to go over all these headlines that are wrong about Russian collusion. Wrong. Wrong. About the Hunter Biden laptop. Wrong. And then there's a story about me. And part of what we went through on this committee during the Biden investigation, which, by the way, ended with Joe Biden's last.
That's Congressman James Comer, Republican from Kentucky, who is on that House subcommittee. We are carrying the live coverage of this subcommittee hearing on our website, wjffradio.org. You can listen and watch while you're there. Support us. Support the public radio you rely on. Our fund drive starts officially for spring on Monday, but you can donate now. Thank you for your support, and thanks for listening. I'm Tim Bruno.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, independent grassroots global news. Our reporting includes breaking daily news headlines and in-depth interviews with people on the front lines of the world's most pressing issues. People speaking for themselves, providing unique and sometimes provocative perspectives on global events. Democracy Now!, weekdays at noon, right here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Much cooler today, if you haven't noticed. Temperatures nearly steady in the mid to upper 30s this afternoon, with some snow showers even possible. Cloudy tonight, low of 22. Tomorrow, sunny, a little warmer, and a high of 44. On Point is next from WBUR Boston. It's 11 o'clock.